Welcome to ITE 1, Module 8, Part 2.
I want to remind everybody that no matter what class you were in or are in, you need to take all of your exams. Some of you are exempt from some of the labs because you were in a previous class, or if somebody's been RPL'd on some labs, you know who you are and what labs you're exempt from, so don't worry about those, but you were all required to take every exam. So if you want to go in and take some of your exams, the sooner you do this, the better, because you'll still remember the material. They don't take too long. It's not nearly as time-consuming as the labs or anything, but you may just want to go in and do some of those so that you do not get bogged down with exams at the end of term. Any questions on exams?
It's probably also worth mentioning that Cisco tends to keep an eye on our grade books. And the better students do in the exams, the better it makes our course look. So if you guys could even do the exams, that would look really good, because there are people who do take a peek at the grade books and see what's going on. So, and the exams do go up. I mean, it's one message to Cavi instructors to get them put up for a week. And seriously, depending on how fast you work on your computer, I can do one of those exams in about 5 minutes, but I'm a freak. You can do them in 15 to 20 minutes, so guys, try and get onto that. We don't like to see an empty grade book, and if anybody's also in my exploration class, that goes for you too. A lot of the exams haven't been tried and completed. Now, in exploration, you get at least 3 attempts on the exam, so I'm too scared is not an excuse. Give it a shot. I can always reset it and give you another attempt. The same goes for ITE1. If you have genuine problems, we will help you and work with you, or Grace will, unless she isn't available. Otherwise, I can certainly go through exams with you if push comes to shove. Either or. And we will go through the exams and tell you what you got wrong and try and teach you something, because it's not until you test yourself that you know how much you really learned, in my experience.
So, I've never taken the full 2 hours that you're allotted for a chapter exam.
No.
I think I might have taken 2 hours on the final, and you're allotted 3 for that. So take your time as well. I mean, it probably won't take you the whole 2 hours, but you've got a lot of time.
And if you really have time problems, call me up. And if it's that big of a deal, if 2 hours is not enough time and you are constantly running out of time, call. We can probably Braille display and read you the questions if really that is a concern. It's never been a concern for anyone so far, though. Any questions on any of that? If you don't see a message go to announce, that doesn't mean that the exams aren't up for a week. That just means nobody emailed me about them, and I just went in and reset them already. So assume they're up unless you go in and they're not. Then email, and you'll get a response back saying that they're up.
Because sometimes, like Grace said, she puts them up and it doesn't, you know, they don't always remember to post to announce the, you know, that they've done it, so yeah.
We try to actually, Sean. We're really big on that. We really try these days. If we do a back activate, posting to posting to announce is probably, you know, we really try to get on that. Unless, of course, like, you know, somebody goes and drives a car through our house between the time that we activate the exams and the time that we post to announce. We really do try and announce it, and these days we try and tweet it. So if you're following us on Twitter, you'll see when the exams go up as well as the announce emails. And I must stress to people very briefly, follow Cisco Vision on Twitter. Please read announce. We don't post things to announce because we're bored and we've got nothing better to do. The announce messages are critical to your success of study. We had a few people who realized yesterday that daylight savings hadn't kicked in, even though we have posted about that a number of times. So please don't arrow past the announce messages. We keep them concise for a reason, and we'd really appreciate if you could read them straight away, and then you can go on and delete them. This is really important.
Well, you all are rock stars anyway, because you did read your announce, because you're all here at the right time. So good on y'all. You all rock. Okay. So, any other questions about coursework or anything else before we start? Okay, I'm guessing that's a no. Cool. We will start with our networking lecture. And we're down a few people because some people have gone on vacations and are out doing various things. And A couple of them will be back tomorrow, or next week, yeah. Can somebody tell me what DHCP does?
It automatically assigns IP addresses.
Sean, you're exempt. That's all right. As an instructor, we
assigns IP address.
Well done, Drew. Well done, Marshall. Sorry, I almost had you confused with Rich, and that would have had me, not very good with anybody. Okay, so, yes.
Well done. So the next thing we're going to talk about, very briefly, is something called DNS, and this makes your lives a whole lot easier. Because imagine if you had to know the IP address of everything you typed in. That would just be quite stressful and time-consuming and awful, because you'd have to type in some random IP address for Google, and for Yahoo, and for any other site that you had to access. When you type a DNS address or a name into your web browser, DNS goes and finds the IP address of that web server and then allows you to visit that site. In a nutshell, any questions on DNS? Your DHCP server can actually give you DNS listings or DNS addresses to go to, and it usually does. Otherwise, you can use a service like OpenDNS, which does a lot of various different things, and if Carrie wants to actually talk about what OpenDNS does, because it's very kind of cool.
I can do that. OpenDNS, in a nutshell, allows you much faster access to name resolution. The faster your names resolve, the quicker your websites load. The quicker your websites load, the happier your users are. There are free access to OpenDNS. There are also small paid plans. If you have a paid plan, you can do things like web filtering. That means in your house, you can filter out porn, Facebook, YouTube, phishing sites, scam sites, email scams. It'll filter out all that with OpenDNS. Because when you try to go to the site, OpenDNS will trap the request, and it will deny it and go, oi, that's a scam, or that's phishing, or whatever, or that's a known malware site. The other thing I would like to mention about DNS and stuff is, no, I've forgotten, so we won't mention that.
You can block all time wasters if you really want to do that. Hello, Carol.
Yeah, so all of that can help. And the other thing is, if you think your DNS might be busted, one of the really good ways to check whether your DNS is actually busted and the rest of it's working is if Skype is working and MSN Messenger or Twitter or all sorts of other things aren't, then you can usually assume that there's a problem with the DNS, because Skype doesn't require DNS to find its supernodes, but most other things do. So that's usually a good hint that your DNS is on the fritz and you might want to look into it.
I've actually thought about getting it, just because there are times when my ISP's DNS drives me nuts, both with their error page and just some sites just don't work.
Well, it's free. If you just want to access the OpenDNS servers without any filtering, it's free. It's one change to your router configuration. I don't know whether it's on, Carol. Put your hand at the back and see if the fan's working.
Hang on.
So, yeah. No, we're just finding out whether the computer was on or not. I would set it up. Change the DNS servers in your router to be the two in OpenDNS, and if you don't know how to do it, well, there's a guide on the OpenDNS website for most popular routers, so there you go. It might be worth a look.
The other thing I do is sometimes if I'm trying to figure out DNS issues, I'll ping IP addresses that I know are external and see if I get responses out of them, and if I do, then okay, I'm connected to the network. But if I ping the same thing by name and it doesn't resolve, okay, we've got some sort of DNS issue.
That is a fantastic idea if you don't feel like launching Skype. Any questions on DNS, what it does, what it's about, any of that? We don't really go into too much detail about DNS. They do a little more of that in Discovery Exploration, but there is a quick little intro to dynamic name services. Okay, I'm guessing we're doing good. And hello. Welcome. All right. So I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but most home ISPs give customers one public IP address. So now that I've told you that, your first question that might pop into your head if you already don't know this is, if we only have one public IP address, how are we able to connect more than one computer to the internet? Your router uses network address translation, or NAT, to translate private addresses of each device to your public address. This is a really, really good thing, because if each computer had a public address, we'd be running out. We'd have already run out of IPv4 addresses long, long, long ago, and there would really be not much more of an. So, that's what NAT does. It also protects you from people actually discovering the IP address of your actual machine.
No, I disagree with that. They always see your external IP address, and the IP addresses of your internal machines are irrelevant. I think it would be better to say that NAT helps limit your network from outside attacks, because traffic won't travel back through the network address translator, but it doesn't do anything to hide IP addresses. I realize that's splitting hairs, but a lot of people will think that if they're behind a NAT and they're torrenting the latest movie, that nobody will see them. No, everybody sees your public IP address, and it's registered on the trackers, and there is actually a database of IP address to latitude and longitude coordinates, and they can come knocking on your door a lot of the time, or they can talk to your ISP, give them a search warrant, and then come knocking on your door.
That's how you get targeted. How websites will attempt to target ads based on where the computer thinks you are based on your IP.
Okay. It won't show the IP address of your actual machine. That's what I was trying to get at. Like the actual computer you're on. It will show your public IP address. All right. So, no, that's completely not a random number.
Just so that you guys know, we're just having an internal conversation here. I just said, yeah, but if it's a non-routable IP address and you're 192.168.1.1, who cares if somebody sees it? But anyway, moving right along.
Absolutely. Okay, next we're going to talk about protocols. A protocol is a set of rules such as how you're going to actually get something from one place or another, or how you're going to do something. The post office is a good example of a protocol. Internet protocols are sets of rules for network communication. When you send a letter in the mail, you are using protocols. The letter won't actually get to the sender unless the return address is in the right place and your address that you want to send the letter is in the right place, and of course you'll need postage. If any of those are missing or in the wrong place, you're going to have trouble getting your letter to the intended recipient, or it might not travel at all. Okay. The main functions of network protocols include identifying errors, compressing the data, deciding how data is to be sent, addressing data, and there's one other very, very important thing that protocols determine, and they determine the timing of messages. Messages must reach their destination within a certain time so that computers don't wait forever to receive messages that have become lost, because packets do become lost. You don't really notice it a lot, but quite a few of your packets just don't exist and they go nowhere. If an expected message fails to reach its destination in the allotted time, the protocol may define alternative steps that the receiving host will take. So they might send back a message saying, we didn't receive this packet, can you send it again? And that packet will come again and you'll be none the wiser. Just going to actually take my sensitivity down up a little bit so that you guys, I don't cut out.
Has anybody ever done net surfing on a dodgy DSL connection, or perhaps on a flaky wireless connection where the connection to the access point drops in and out? And have you ever seen how, you know, websites sort of freeze and stuff, but if you're really, really lucky, things recover? That's the sort of thing we're talking about, messages not arriving in time and timeouts being exceeded. In fact, anybody who's got one of those horrible USB dongles and happens to be sitting on the wrong side of a brick wall or in the wrong room of your house will have experienced that horrible connectivity to the internet, which is just dicey as. We've got a lot of 3G dongles and stuff over here that let you get on mobile if you're in range of the 3G networks. So that can certainly be an example where, you know, Google won't load or whatever. Is everyone awake this morning?
Absolutely.
Aye, aye.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, wow. Just...
Oh, right. We just want
Isn't
to make
sure...
Isn't
the largest reaction we ever got?
Wow.
Basically, wow. Well, we're going to keep you awake because we're all going to go through the the protocols, and we're going to just do a little matching activity in a bit, too. So, stand by. This will be fun. All right. Some protocols are actually a group of protocols that are dependent on each other. All right, sorry. Okay, so some protocols are actually groups of protocols that are dependent on each other, and these are called suites. TCP/IP is an example of a suite of protocols.
So is IPX-SPX?
Yep. IPSXPX.
IPXSPX. We don't cover it, but it is another protocol suite. It's just to show you that there isn't just one suite.
Yeah, it's just old. Anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute. We visualize these protocol suites as being layered. Imagine a layered cake, like the Black Forest cheesecake that I'll be getting for my wedding. Yum. You've got the crust, you've got a layer of chocolate, and you've got the cherry gooey cream in the middle. So the crust has different ingredients in it. So that is one layer of the protocol suite. So that might have more than one actual layer in it. Whereas the layer of chocolate is just chocolate alone, so one protocol might make up that layer. Does that make sense?
And if you happen to be coming to our wedding on Monday night, you'll get some of this yummy cake. But if you're not, then you can just dream about it because we love Black Forest cherry cake. Or Schwarzwälder Kirschtorte. Well, it could have seven layers. We could make that happen. Or we could buy like two, you know.
No, I want a cake with four layers and a cake with seven layers. One for the TCP/IP model and one for the OSI model. You guys will understand this joke in about 30 minutes. So hold that thought. All right. So
I wish you'd have thought of these food analogies last semester. That would have been great.
Because it works. It's working for last year. Because
oh, that's right. You did.
These. Okay. So. As I said, it can be made up of one protocol or many protocols. It just depends. We're going to go over the table one in class, but for some of these protocols, but there's this whole huge table two that basically goes into excruciating detail about a bunch of these old protocols and different protocols and really what they do, who made them, all sorts of stuff. Read this table, guys, because it's very interesting. You don't have to know it all, but very good to know, and great knowledge to have. All right. TCP/IP. It doesn't actually go out on any kind of port because, again, it's a protocol suite. It's a suite of protocols used to transport data on the internet. We've got NetBUI, or NetBIOS. This is can go on port 137, 139, or 150.
Does the lab say NetBIOS or NetBUI?
It says, it's
the
what
instructions
it says
last
is NetBUI/NetBIOS.
Ah, that's actually two different protocols. They're not one or the other, because NetBIOS is actually a transport layer that can either run over NetBUI or TCP/IP or IPX-SPX. But you don't need to know that unless you're in exploration. But yeah, NetBUI is an old LAN protocol that I think died a horrible death. It was still implemented in Windows XP. Does anybody know if there's any NetBUI support left in Vista and 7, or did they finally kill it dead?
I don't even know what it
is. I would say Wikipedia.
I don't think it's in there.
I haven't used XP.
I think it's gone. It might be. Okay. Maybe Home Group is that in disguise.
Ooh, I hope not.
Nah. I don't think so.
NetBUI.
It's a horrible thing.
NetBUI actually did have a place. NetBUI was a configurationless LAN protocol. So you put the computers on the network, you named them, and it worked. And that's what NetBUI was for. It was for little workgroup networks with no configuration at all, which meant that users couldn't break it. So it was very successful for its time until networking just went mental.
NetBIOS is kind of still does that kind of thing.
No, but you can still get the IP address wrong. At least with NetBUI, there was no IP address to set. It was all based on the MAC addresses.
Fair enough.
There was nothing you had to set up except for the computer name and the workgroup name.
Okay, well, there you go.
That's pretty.
We've got it on 137, 139, and 150. It's a small, fast protocol designed for a work group network that requires no connection to the internet. We've got IPSXPX, and this is also portless. It is a suite of protocols used to transport data on an older Novell network, or NetWare network. You're never going to see this anymore. All right. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to play a game to keep you all awake. I'm going to describe a protocol, tell you the port, and I want you guys, and no pressure on getting this right or wrong, because you're not expected to know this. I want somebody to write their name into chat. I'll call on you, and you get to have a guess as to which protocol you think it is. Once you've answered, you can't answer again, so it's going to be up to everybody else to answer.
And I'll be quiet.
Go through just about everybody, and then we'll let everybody else have another go at answering. All right. So this protocol is on port 80. It is a communication protocol that establishes request/response connections on the internet. Go. Conrad, go.
HTTP.
Good job.
HTTP.
All right, Conrad's out. Yes, good job. All right, the next one is on port 443. This is a protocol that uses authentication encryption to secure data as it travels between the client and web server. Hint, PayPal. Okay, go. Answer, or don't answer, name. Curtis, go. No. Rich, do you want to go?
HTTPS.
Absolutely. Curtis, you're still in. Rich, good job. You're out. All right.
The reason that is technically incorrect, if anybody cares, is that...
Is the port number.
No, it's not. No. SSL is actually Secure Sockets Layer, and it can actually be layered on top of any port-based protocol. So, for example, you can have S-Telnet, which is Secure Telnet, which uses SSL, now known as TLS, or Transport Layer Security, that sits on top of any TCP port-to-port connection, whereas HTTPS refers specifically to the secure transport of TLS or HTTPS over port 443. Whew, that was complex.
All right. Next one, ports 20 and 21. Description, a protocol that provides services for file transfer and manipulation. Go, Randy.
FTP.
Good job. All right. The next one, port 22, a protocol used to securely connect to remote network devices. Go, Curtis.
No. Someone else?
Anyone else?
Is that secure FTP?
No.
No, it's not.
No.
I'll give you a clue. Shh, or I'll bash you.
Ah, that was my other guess.
Yeah. Well done.
There you go. Yeah. All right. So, all right. Now, where is it? Okay. Here we go. I just kind of lost my place. Okay. Next one is port 23. A protocol used to connect to a remote network device. Anyone want to go? Rich, go ahead.
Telnet.
Good job. Absolutely right.
Seriously, guys, if you guys want to work these out really, really quick and you kind of want to cheat, you could crack open Google and go port 23, and it would tell you what protocol it was.
And you don't have to get them right. It's just wild guesses, and it's all good. Okay. How about the next one? This is kind of an easier one. Port 110, a protocol used to download email messages from an email server. Go ahead, Bob.
POP 3.
Good job. Okay, that's right. And the next one, its cousin, port 143, a protocol used to download email messages from an email server. Drew, go ahead.
Well, I'd assume that would be IMAP.
All right.
It's actually IMAP version 4, but that's okay. It's IMAP.
Yes.
It's IMAP. And I think this is going to be the last one. Yep. We've got a protocol on port 25 sometimes, most of the time. sort of. This is used to send mail in a TCP/IP network. Go ahead, Gary.
Would that be SMTP?
That would be. Good job.
Well, actually, technically speaking, SMTP should always run on port 25. It was just stupid implementations of the secure versions that decided to run them on 995 and 465 and all this other stuff. And then Microsoft broke Outlook Express so that it couldn't actually negotiate security on port 25, so you had to change the port number or it would refuse to negotiate. So until Outlook Express dies a horrible death, which should hopefully happen in about 10 years, we are stuck with running secure SMTP on really odd ports. It should theoretically just negotiate TLS on 25.
Okay. We are done with that. Hopefully everybody enjoyed that, and we are now sort of awake. And awake enough to fall asleep while talking about Internet Control Messaging Protocol. ICMP, one of those things that you hear about and you're like, what is that? And you really need to know it. Okay, it's used by devices on a network to send control error messages to computers and servers. It has many functions, including announcing network errors, announcing network congestion, and troubleshooting. Now, the best example, and we're going to see ICMP in action here if you choose to follow along with me in your book, is called ping. Has anyone ever used ping?
Yes.
Yes.
Has anyone ever not used ping?
That's kind of a weird question. Did they say yes or no?
Who hasn't used ping?
Yeah, who hasn't used ping? Has anyone not used ping?
Okay, or say something. And it's okay if you haven't, but just let us know, because... All right. Well, for all of us that want to do this, let's open up a command prompt. So we're going to hit Windows R, and type in CMD.
That's Charlie Mike Delta. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, press Enter so that it opens up the command prompt.
Okay, good. All right. Now what we're going to do is ping. I think this is going to work. www.qcat.org, because I believe that is
Google. Does that work? Google.com does work. Ping www.google.com will work.
No, QCAT does work. But
it works for you internally. Does it work externally? Because
not externally. Yes, it does.
Have you? Right, I'll fix that
it
later
works.
Today. It's going to stop working.
It doesn't work for me.
No? ING space... www.qcat.org
or www.google.com, which is definitely pingable. It always responds.
Yes, Google responds, but qcat.org does not.
Weird.
Probably intentional.
It's just kind of odd because it.
I'll try it from home.
Okay. Now, what's happened here? Yep. What you're going to see here is that it's pinging with 4 packets of data. And what's happening here is that the ICMP protocol is sending out what is called an echo request to Google or QCAT and saying, hey, pinging you, can you read me? And if that ping actually gets to Google or QCAT, the website is going to reply and say, yes, I can hear you. And this is going to happen 4 times. Once this has happened, the ping command is going to give you a result. It's going to say that it's pinged it with 32 bytes of data, which is 4 packets, and it's going to tell you how many messages it got back.
It is pingable. Grace is correct. I don't know why you can't ping it. Brian, maybe your NAT doesn't like ping, although that would be odd. But yeah, I can ping it from home, and it pings 203.161.101. Whatever static amnet .au, and yeah, it pings.
Interestingly,
I got it.
Oh, that's okay.
That's okay.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, interestingly enough, in the BrailleNote menu somewhere, there were, under one of the advanced things, there was ping, and when you did it, it would make different sounds. So if the website was answering you back, it would click, but if it was timing out each time it didn't receive anything, it would go whoosh. So you could listen to it and tell what kind of ping you were going to get before you actually got the message back.
Cool.
I don't remember how. I don't remember where it was.
The other thing is, a lot of people don't realize this either. There is actually an audible option to ping for Linux, I think it's ping-a, I'm not quite sure, and it will actually beep the system speaker when a packet comes back, and if a packet doesn't come back, it won't, so you can actually use it to tell whether cables are plugged in and stuff. And I've used it, I don't know whether that option is available, but you can try, otherwise you can do a man ping, which is not the name of a new Chinese restaurant, and you can... And you can read the manual page for pinging and see if there's an audible option for the Mac. But yeah, it will go beep beep when it works and stuff. Very useful if you've got to ping something, walk away and fiddle with cables and see if it's working or not. And then if you're a real geek, you get like, you know, two iPhones and leave one in with the server going beep beep and then, you know, Skype into the other one so that you can, you know, hear the pings from the other room.
Oh my goodness. And then you've just become really, really, really geeky.
It wow, does have that option. Whatever your default alert sound will play. I just did it, and it worked.
Wow.
Hey, that is really cool.
Yeah.
Somebody else had something to say, so you go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious on the address that was supposed to come back. I had got a 203.161.99, I think, 234.
That's right. Sorry, I was confusing the old IP address we had. I used to have an AMCOM address as well, and my brain just scrambled the digits. But yeah, 234 is the one you want.
Carol thinks you are incredible for remembering all of those digits.
What was the Google line from the run window?
Go run, and then go Charlie Mike Delta, in other words, CMD to open the command prompt. Do not ping directly from the command from the run dialog, because if you do, as soon as the ping exits, the window closes, and you'll never get to see what it said. It's just gone. So you go CMD, and you press enter, and then when the command prompt comes up, you go ping www.google.com.
Ping space.
Okay. Yeah, there's a space.
www.google.com, enter. Okay. Another thing you can do, and I can't think of an IP address to actually maybe Carrie can tell us the QCAT one, and you can type it in, and you can actually type in an IP address and see if you can ping that exact IP address as well. So if you just know the IP address of somebody, a host on your network, possibly, you can do that as well. And that can be very helpful.
You can ping your default gateway and make sure your router's okay.
Absolutely.
Or, here's one that I don't actually know what it refers to, but it's an easy IP address to type. If you ping 203.203.203.203, you will get a ping response. So there you go.
Did you just try that?
I did.
Out of your
Wow, okay, fair enough. And we should probably tell you what ping stands for, so there are no surprises. Ping stands for Packet Internet Groper.
It's from the old sonar term. Has anybody seen those movies where it goes all the way through the movie, and then people shoot torpedoes at each other, and then there's like explosions and glub, glub, glub? Well, that's where ping comes from. And there was an expression, it don't mean a thing if you don't get that ping. And it was when you were... Well, it was saying you could actually, line your torpedoes up and blow the U-boats out of the water and stuff. Hunt for the Red October style.
My God, how many numbers should you get? It just went on and on and on.
It actually gives you 4 packet responses, and it says 64 bytes from whatever the IP address, IP_sec=1, TTL=blah, then it says 64 bytes from blah, IP_sec, and it does that 4 times. And then it stops, but okay. It seems like a lot.
And if you're on the Mac and you're not careful, it'll do it until you hit Control-C.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, so does Linux. It's in ping indefinite.
If you forget to tell it how many times, I still don't remember how to do it.
-C and a number. And I think it's -T to tell it to keep doing it under Windows too, but I wouldn't recommend it.
No, probably not a good idea.
Okay. I should probably not strand you guys in your command line windows, so whenever you're ready to leave, you just type in exit and press enter, and that window will close for you. Other ICMP messages are used to report undelivered packets, data on an IP... Go ahead. Oh, fair enough. Undelivered packets, data on an IP network that includes source and destination IP addresses, and whether a device is too busy to handle the packets. So the device will send off and say, back off, try again later, I'm busy. Data in the form of a packet arrives at a router, which is a networking device that forwards data packets across networks towards their destinations. If the router does not know where to send the packet, this is a test question. If it does not know where to send the packet, the router deletes it. It is gone. No attempt to do anything else with it. It is just gone if the router does not know where to send a packet. If a router does not know where to send a packet, it is just gone. There is a free point on a couple of tests, I believe. So there you go. The router sends an ICMP message back to the sending computer informing it that the data was deleted. We don't know where you sent this to. I delete the data. Try again and have a correct destination address. When a router becomes very busy, it might send a different ICMP message to the sending computer indicating that it should slow down due to congestion on the network.
Why do they even tell us this? It's just weird.
I don't know. Honestly, they have a whole section devoted to ICMP.
Man, it's not as if you're sort of walking along the street and all of a sudden this crowd of people in front of you goes, hey man, source quench! So you slow down and wait. I mean, I just can't see why this is in here, but you know, moving right along. They are the sort of ICMP messages you can get. I just haven't seen anybody trip over a source quench in the last 15 years, you know?
No, but there it is. Now you guys know all you'll ever need to know and more about ICMP. No idea, really. Any questions on it, though?
It sort of reminds me of handshaking in the serial days, in some respects.
Sort of.
At least the slow down, I'm busy part.
Yeah. Any questions? Does everybody sort of kind of understand this? Basically, all you really need to know is ping is an ICMP command. You need to know that ICMP is Internet Control Message Protocol, and you need to know that it sends control. It handles control messages. That's really basically it.
And that when you ping stuff and you get nothing back, then you have a problem and you have to fix it.
That's a different module. They don't actually have to know that. But now you do since you've played with it. That's module 10.
I was just saying that's how you know when there's a problem.
Yep. All right. Now that we've talked about protocols, we're coming back to some of this in a little bit when we talk about the layered models. Fun. We get to talk about physical network devices. All right, so we need physical network devices to actually take care of sending our data. The first network device we're going to talk about is a hub. Now, this is different to a USB hub. You might see a USB hub. You're probably not going to see these. They're very simple network devices. When they receive data, they forward it out through every other port. Since all devices receive the transmission, hubs create a lot of network traffic, and networks that use hubs are very slow. Hubs are not often used in modern networks. There's really no need for a big multiport repeater. Now, the one thing you need to remember about hubs is that a hub actually does not send the data out the port that the data was sent from, only every other port. So do remember that. If it says hub send out data out through all ports, that's wrong. If it says that they send out data through every other port besides the one that has been sent out, that's right. It can be very confusing, and it's easy to lose a point on a quiz for that.
So hub is sort of like, but kind of not like a wire, like a headphone splitter.
No, because the hub actually does signal retiming and regeneration, and a Y cable doesn't. A Y cable just splits the signal in half, whereas a hub actually has some smarts to do signal regeneration and retransmission, and it's also smart enough to not send the signal back out the other ports as well. So, yeah. Yes.
Marshall, go ahead.
So that means if, let's say you have about 1 to 4 hub, and a packet comes in on one of the four side of things, it actually broadcasts it out, you know, not only the port headed up the tree or down the tree, but it sends it out to the other three ports as well?
what's going to happen, if you've got a packet that has been sent out from port 1, it's going to send that packet out to ports 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah, so the packet doesn't go back out to port 1. Yeah, so...
That's the important thing. It goes out to every single other port on the device, but not the one that sent it.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
Hubs are pretty rare, though, these days, luckily.
Yeah, you're not going to see these. They're not good.
Anyone seen a hub lately? I have, but then I'm a freak. Anybody else?
Is there a difference between a hub and a switch?
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, and we're just going to go into that next after we talk about bridges. This will happen. Hubs technically work at the physical layer of the OSI reference model. That's going to help people in exploration, but no one else at the moment. It will a little bit, though. Switches work at a higher layer and are much smarter than hubs. I saw a hub, actually, in hardware class in 08, I think it was, 09. And they really don't feel anything different than to a switch. You cannot tell the difference by touching. But this is not something you need to worry about, because I don't even know where you can get hubs.
You can still buy them for very specialized situations, but you would need a very good reason to do so.
Any other questions on hubs? Cool. We'll go on. Remember that files are broken up into smaller chunks called packets when being sent over a network. This allows for error checking, and if the packet gets lost, then only the packet needs to be retransmitted. It would be really bad if you sent big files, and if the file got lost, you'd just waste so much bandwidth trying to get the file back over and over if it kept getting lost. Whereas if one little packet gets lost, it just asks for that packet to be retransmitted. It is, and we move on with life. Packet loss happens all the time without you even being aware of it most of the time. Address information is added to the beginning and end of a packet when it is transmitted, and this packet along with the address information is called a frame. Frames are often, and that is important for the next section. It's not completely random. LANs are often divided into sections called segments, similar to the way a company is divided into departments. The boundary of the segments can be defined using a bridge. A bridge is a device used to filter network traffic between LAN segments. Bridges keep a record of all devices on each segment to which the bridge is connected. The bridge receives a frame. The destination address is examined by the bridge to determine if the frame is to be sent to a different segment or dropped. The bridge also helps to improve the flow of data by keeping frames confined to only the segment to which the frame belongs. Bridges aren't really that common either.
They are if you're bridging, for example, fiber onto twisted pair. Often a bridge contains a media transform, so you'll often see bridges if you're doing... Actually, bridges are quite common if you're working with access points. Often a wireless access point shows up as a two-port bridge. That's okay. Kerry, gladly throwing a spanner into your lecture since 2002. Okay, moving right along.
Okay. Now we're on to what Bob was asking about, switches, which are sometimes called multi-port bridges, because they can have many ports. I think this is a little misleading, because they're much more complex than bridges and smarter. A switch maintains a table of MAC addresses for computers that are connected to each port. When a frame arrives at a port, the switch compares the address information in the frame to its MAC address table. The switch then determines which port to use to forward the frame. This causes much less confusion on the network because each port on a switch is its own network segment. So it's much smarter than a hub. It's not going to repeat the message out to all of the ports. It's only going to repeat the message out to the one port that needs to get the message. So Hubs repeat everything. Switches connect network segments, and routers connect networks to each other. They can be computers with special networking software or a standalone device built by a network equipment manufacturer, such as Linksys or D-Link.
Hubs are kind of like those people that know everybody's stuff and tell everybody.
Switches are actually confidential and will only deliver your message to the person that it's supposed to go to. Switches use MAC tables and the MAC address to move things around in a network. Routers use IP addresses to transport frames between networks. Routers contain tables of IP addresses along with optimal destination routes to other networks. Okay. Any questions on hubs, switches, bridges, and routers?
Could you run through the bridge again?
Absolutely. The bridge is going to connect two network segments, say a wired network to a wireless network. The access point will be basically a two-port bridge connecting the wired LAN to the wireless.
Let's summarize here. A repeater is a single port. We don't talk about repeaters in this module, but it's a single port juncture from one network to another, but it doesn't do any filtering. A hub is a multi-port repeater. Okay, so a repeater with multiple ports, in other words, it repeats out multiple ports. A bridge is to bridge two network segments together from one segment to another, so it can be the same media or it can be fiber to whatever. A switch is a multi-port bridge. So just think of a switch as a bridge on acid that went to Woodstock or something, okay? So
that's way smarter than...
I'll never forget that again. Awesome.
Does that explain it, Bob?
Yes, that's much better. Thanks.
Cool. Okay. Any other questions? Are we all good, or are we all just too confused?
I think I get it better now than I used to. Thanks, Kim.
That's all right. You can talk to us outside of lecture, Carol. So.
Yeah, Carol, you're here. We'll help you.
We can just keep talking to you until you go mad. Yeah, it's cool. You're here and local. Anybody else, if you have any questions, feel free to ask us. Yeah, that's right.
She's just the helpless victim that gets to stay with us all day. Imagine having to be in ITE1 until 3 today, guys.
Hey, that'd be okay, I think, maybe.
You'd love it, but... Okay, looks like we're all good or all asleep or either way. Well, as we said. All right. Wireless access points allow devices to connect to networks wirelessly using radio waves. As previously discussed, they have a limited range, so multiple access points may be needed for different sections of the networks. So, you're wondering why you don't have a switch, a router, and an access point and bridges. You only have one box. This is because most home users purchase multi-purpose devices. They are smaller, cheaper, and it is easier to configure one device rather than three. These usually contain a switch, a router, and a wireless access point. And they may have the equipment to actually connect up to your DSL modem or whatever. If necessary, some of those actually are built in. Any questions on that? You may see these called ISRs, integrated service routers. So if you see that term, that's what they used to be called, but now they're calling them multi-purpose devices.
I like ISR because it's geeky.
I liked ISR too, but well, that's okay. All good? Are we ready to talk about cables? Any questions on the actual devices? Okay. Now it is time to talk about cables used in networking. Twisted pair cable is used for telephone wiring and Ethernet cabling. In this type of cable, each pair of wires makes a circuit on which data can travel. The two wires are twisted together to provide protection against crosstalk, which is noise generated by other pairs of wire in the same cable. Now look, if you're ever talking to anybody, friendly blindy hint, you may hear Jaws say, "Crows talk." I said this in a lecture and got completely laughed at. So it is crosstalk, and Jaws just says it wrong.
Well, eloquence just says it wrong.
Eloquence.
It's eloquence's fault. There are that many bugs in the eloquent speech synthesizer.
DevTalk actually does that one correctly, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Tasia, anyone? And the other words that crash eloquence?
Huh?
Yeah, CEISURE, which was fixed a long time ago, but there's some new ones that...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, all sorts of bugs in the speech engine that we know and love.
Does eloquence fix it, or does Jaws just put in a dictionary?
No, Jaws fixes it. Yeah, it's not eloquence.
Eloquence has been
is
dead
no longer
for
being
ages.
Developed.
Be careful, the note takers still have these.
Really?
Yeah, they do, and they don't have the exception dictionaries to protect you, so you can take down Braille notes by the score, or whatever's got eloquence in it, or Braille senses.
I'm gonna try that on my Braille sense.
Make sure you...
Cool!
Yeah, you may have
I'll
to do
it.
A hard reset.
I'll try it.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. I just won't do it with all my notes open and unsaved, but at some point I will have to try it. Alright. Okay. Pairs of copper wires are encased in color-coded plastic insulation and twisted together. An outer jacket protects the bundle of twisted pairs. When electricity flows through a copper wire, a magnetic field is created around the wire. A circuit has two wires in a circuit, and the two wires have oppositely charged magnetic fields. When the two wires of the circuit are next to each other, the magnetic fields cancel each other out. This is called the cancellation effect. There are two, that whole little paragraph there, you do not need to know for your test. I don't really, I'm not an electrical engineer, so really that's about all of the information on how the electrical, the electricity actually works on these things that I have. So if you're interested in that...
Discovery or exploration. The reason they mention it is because some people do try to run...
Wikipedia, I was going to say.
Oh, okay, yeah, well, the reason they do mention this is because some people do get straight through copper cable that isn't twisted pair, and then they crimp RJ45s on the end and wonder why their network doesn't work. So that's why they mention that it has to be twisted pair. And
why would you do that?
Because you're cheap and you've got, like, you know, 20 meters of cable in the shed and you think you know how those networks work, so if you just stick these things on the end and plug it in, that's none of us, right?
But you could get, like, huge bunches of network cable from eBay for unbelievably cheap. Just why? Anyway, sorry. Off the soapbox now.
Come on, who's seen dodgy workmanship anywhere around when they've worked? Anybody seen dodgy workmanship? You know, dicey cables, badly done cables.
I've got a good one. Okay, I had cables being installed into my house for AT&T Uverse, and the guy is trying to crimp the cable and fix up this cable. And his company didn't even give him the correct tools to actually fix up this cable properly. And I'm just sitting there and going, what?
What?
He almost had to go back to the company to pick up a specialized tool that he probably should have had in his toolkit to fix up some wires that he cut. And I actually went and put in a complaint on his behalf saying, your technician wasn't actually equipped with the right tools. You might want to check on that. So, yeah, not to get him in trouble, but basically to let them know. And he was quite happy for me to do that because it was something that was really bothering him. So, yeah, there you go. Two types of twisted pair cabling. We've got unshielded twisted pair, or STP. And this is the less expensive, more common variety used in networks. You will have seen this all over. It's the bendy, flexible, about half an inch around, about as big as, my middle finger. It has four pairs of wires. This type of cable relies solely on the cancellation effect produced by the twisted wire pairs. That limits the signal degradation caused by electromagnetic interference, EMI, and radio frequency interference. And has a range of, this is testable, 100 meters or 328 feet. Okay, guys, how many meters can a P piece of unshielded twisted pair cable go? Just write it down. You put it in chat because you will need to know this on your final class. It's final question. At least in one of the classes you get to take. 100. Yeah. Very special note of that. 100 meters or 328 feet for unshielded. Really, really important. All right. The other type of twisted pair cabling is called shielded twisted pair, or STP. Each pair of wires is wrapped in a metallic foil to better shield the wires from noise. Four pairs of wires are then wrapped in an overall metallic braid foil or foil, and this reduces electrical noise from within the cable. It also reduces EMI and RFI from outside of the cable. It's more expensive and harder to install because it's so thick and it isn't very flexible at all. And you're not going to see this very much in the United States or anywhere. In fact, I've never seen any shielded twisted pair cable. Has anyone else?
You just said RFI, and I thought you said ORFI. Just, that was a sad moment. For anybody who doesn't know...
Is that for cable television?
Yes, it is. Is cable television, is that 70 ohm? But 75 ohms, though, for cable, isn't it?
It's... Which is?
Cable TV coax, 75 ohm coax? Yeah, I would have thought so. And then networking's 50, so it's actually a different diameter and stuff. Yeah, but it is coax, it's just a different impedance.
No, we weren't talking about coax. We're talking about shielded twisted pair.
Okay. Yeah, those network boxes that you get that you can watch your TV by plugging the cable into the back of it, that's a network cable, that's unshielded twisted pair, and that's becoming quite popular. They actually cable your house with unshielded twisted pair, and then they just do TV over IP, or IPTV,
I don't know
as
why
they call it.
I don't know why shielded twisted pair... I think it would make sense to use it in some instances more than unshielded.
Well, the thing is it's so much more expensive, and it's less flexible, very hard to install. And the benefits really, or the disadvantages outweigh the benefits a lot of times.
Oh, okay.
But I've never seen any. I just was wondering if anyone else had ever actually seen a piece of shielded twisted pair cabling and could tell us anything about it.
I've seen it. It's basically like unshielded twisted pair, except it is far less flexible. Because it has the foil shield around the outside, it's harder to bend. So it's a bit like trying to bend coax, if anybody's tried to bend the RG300 style coax, the big fat stuff, not the thin stuff for network, but the one that's between that and thick net. It's really thick and difficult to bend, and it's hard to bend around corners.
Like the stuff that goes between my modem and the... No, that's thin. Never mind.
What was the anachronism for the unshielded? I thought it was STP.
UTP. UTP. Unshielded.
Okay, makes sense. I missed that, thank you.
And thank you for bringing that up. You'll want to know that for the test. So, thank you for that. Good question, and good thing to actually go over that one more time for everybody. You'll see those acronyms. There's a problem. I actually just didn't read this, and this is the big one as to why we don't use it. The metal shielding needs to be grounded at both ends. If this is done wrong, which it's easy to do, the shield acts as an antenna, and it picks up all of the unwanted signals instead of shielding from them. Oh, that is the other huge reason it's not used. So we're back to unshielded twisted pair, and we're going to talk about the categories that it comes on in. The categories are based on two factors, number of wires in the cable and the twists in these wires. Category 3, also you'll hear it referred to as Cat 3, Cat 4, Cat 5, they don't always just say category, they shorten it. This is wiring used for telephone systems and for Ethernet LANs at 10 Mbps. So if you feel your phone cable, this is going to be a Cat 3 cabling. It has four pairs of wires. Category 3 telephone cable is usually terminated by an RJ11 connector. Everybody knows what an RJ11 connector feels like? for phone. Pay attention, stop looking at your Twitter. So you don't ask questions like that.
I didn't even mic up and ask the question. I'm not doing this course. Sorry. I've already done ITE 1. Yeah, smack.
He'd asked me what RJ11, he's like, why are we talking about RJ11? I'm like, telephone, because he thought I might have been talking about network RJ11.
So I was just making sure she hadn't confused RJ11 and 45, but no, I'll just go back to reading my Twitter. Thank you, Grace.
No, that's usually something I don't do. Now we're going to talk about RJ45 connectors, though. We've got Category 5 and Category 5E, and actually I do have a question for Carrie. It doesn't say anything in the book. What is Category 4?
It is an intermediate standard between 3 and 5, and nobody really cares, which is why they don't tell you. 3 was an original, I believe, Category 3...
A telephone and 10 base T.
Yeah, but it also, you only needed to have two pairs for the network, and you could use the other two pairs for telephone wiring, and there were less twists per meter. Category 4 was an intermediate standard between 3 and 5, although technically to run gigabit you need Cat 5E. So, yeah, nobody cares about Cat 4 anymore. And in fact, if you're still running Cat 3, you've got a really old building, and unless you've got heritage reasons and stuff, you should so be upgrading to at least Cat 5E, preferably 6 if you're doing a new install.
Yeah, basically you're going to run the Cat 3 for only your telephone line now.
Well, most people run their telephone lines over voice over IP, so you can run the wiring and the phones and the computers on the same wiring. That's what happens here at the association.
In the U.S., a lot of people still have landlines, or they have a cell phone.
But that's actually, it's sort of catching on, but like the cable companies are offering VoIP now over their digital, but it's using a digital part of the cable spectrum.
The problem with voice over IP is that there's problems with sound quality, and sometimes you can bits of speech, and other times you just don't words that you should have, and then it's, yeah, so obviously it's not as hot as people would like to think, although if it works for you, that's good.
So if you have a real landline, you'll be able to see some Cat 3 cabling. Okay, so we've got Category 5 and Category 5E. They have four pairs of wires with a transmission rate of 100 megabits per second. Category 5 and 5E are most common network cables used. Category 5E has more twists per foot than Category 5 wiring. These extra twists further prevent interference from outside sources and the other wires within the cable. And these are terminated by an RJ45 connector, which is a larger connector. Don't do it now, but if you have a router, you can unplug the cable from the back of the router and take a look at your your RJ45 connector, if you're brave and all that.
Well, you can also, if you're good at ducking and running very fast and you have teenage children, you can rip the cable out from their computer while they're surfing Facebook, and then when they storm out in a huff, you can have a quiet night. Just be careful when they come back.
All right. Some Category 6 cables use a plastic divider to separate the pairs of wires, which prevent interference. The pairs also have more twists than Category 5E cables, all of these terminate in the RJ45. Cat 6 is a little bit thicker, I believe, and less flexible than your Category 5E.
That makes sense if it's got plastic in it, like plastic dividing bits, then yeah, it probably wouldn't be as flexible.
An RJ11 telephone connector has 6 pins, and an RJ45 connector has 8 pins. You want to keep this in mind for your tests. So 11 has 6, 45 has 8, 45 has more than 11. So there you go. Any questions on any of the twisted pair cabling? Because we're going to go into coax next.
Just a wobbly point. Does anybody, and I might have to Wikipedia this up and I'll post to the lists, I've never been clear on the differences between RJ11 and RJ12, and I know one of them's the little one and one of them's the bigger one. And apparently the bigger one is used for phones. No, it's 11 and 12. And then 12 is what actually... Is, and that's the one used for handset.
12 is
the
for the
cable
receiver.
Goes from,
yeah,
the handset to the phone.
I think so. And if you're very careful, you can discover what I did. If you have the right phone receiver, you can get that little plug into the RJ11 and hear what other people are talking about on the phone, and they can't hear you. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, and the other thing you can also do as a good April Fool's joke is pull the RJ12 cable out of the handset so that when people pick up the handset, it's not actually connected to the phone, so the call gets answered, but they can't talk to anyone. But now we've finished being really dicey, and let's get back to the lecture.
Wow. Any questions, guys? Cool. All right. We will move on to coax cable. It's a copper cable surrounded by a heavy shielding. There are several types of coaxial cable. You guys are going to recognize coax cable from your adventures with cable. If you have cable TV or have any kind of cable ports, it's a round connector in the wall, and you've got a connector with one pin in the center and a little kind of nut thing that spins around, and you screw it into the wall. Really bad description, isn't it?
F-connector.
Yep. Does everybody know what I'm on about? Does anyone not know what
it's
I'm on about?
It's not a bad description if you've ever seen one, but if you've never seen one, it might not work.
Okay, good.
Basically, one of the things you can do, and some electronics stores, and I've actually done this, they've actually got like racks of different connectors and wall plates and stuff, and on the day before my previous wedding, I was actually standing in J-Car waiting for a cab to turn up, and I was just rummaging around in all of the little trays, feeling all the different connectors and looking at them, and Gemma's like, stop doing that, you're making a mess, and one of the guys said, no he's not, he's putting all the plugs back in the right places, which is more than we do, leave him alone.
That's awesome. Okay, so there are several types of coaxial cables. ThickNet 10 base 5 coax cables using a network and operating at 10 Mbps with a maximum length of 500 meters or 1640.4 feet. That is a lot farther than you're going to get any kind of twisted pair cable to go. Whoa. ThinNet 10 base 2 coax cable used in networks and operates at 10 Mbps per second with a maximum length of 185 meters or 607 feet. RJ59, most commonly used for cable television in the US, and that's what you're going to see on the back of your TV and what you're probably most likely to have encountered. We've got RJ6, higher quality cable than RJ59, with more bandwidth and less susceptibility to interference. You won't be seeing many of these cables anymore, really. They're going to be on that because it's cheap.
No, you will if you're doing RF work. If you're doing RF work, you will see all of these cables. If you're a ham, you'll have seen this stuff. If you're a TV installer, you'll see this stuff. Even though 300 ohm TV tape is more resistant to interference if laid correctly, people have tended to shift to the coax. And even if you've got digital TV, it's all still coming in on coax. So as a network person, you may not see it, but if you're doing anything with RF, and especially if you're doing stuff with high-end Wi-Fi, you'll see coax a fair bit.
What I meant was just in networking terms, you're really not. They don't do too much of this anymore. Okay. In networking, I didn't mean like TV and stuff, but in networking, they don't do too much of this anymore. What they do now is optical fiber, which is made out of glass and plastic conductors that transmit information using light. These cables have one or more fibers inside of a sheath. Has anyone ever gone to like Spencer's Gifts and felt the fiber optic lamps, the little strands with all the little colors that show through? Does anyone know what I'm on about? Okay, that is what the inside of a fiber optic cable feels like. There's just these little strands, and I got to see something really, really cool at and that's open day, which sadly is on the day of our wedding and we can't go to, and we're really disappointed about it because we're such dorks, is a piece of an underground fiber optic cabling that was part of the pipeline from Australia to Guam. And this thing had about 2 inches of shielding around it, and inside of it were these little fiber wires. And it was really cool to get to see that. Because it is made of glass, fiber optic cable is not affected by EMI or RFI. The signals are converted to light pulses to enter the cable and then converted back into electrical signals when they leave it. This means that fiber optic cable can deliver signals that are clearer and can go farther and have greater bandwidth than cables made of copper or other metals. Fiber optic cables can reach distances of several miles or kilometers before signals need to be regenerated. There we go. Fiber cables are more expensive than other types of cables, and their connectors are harder to assemble. So you're going to see these more for very long distance things. You're not going to have most of the time fiber to your door. They're working on that here in Australia, possibly, which would be very cool. Common connectors for fiber optic networks are SC, ST, and LC. These three types of fiber optic connectors are half duplex, which allows data to flow in only one direction, so two cables are needed. All you really need to know for this, guys, for the connectors, is their abbreviations, which are SC, ST, and LC. That's it. There are two types of fiber optic cables. Cables that have, there's a multimode, and these are cables that have a thicker core than single mode cable. It's easier to make because you can use simpler light sources, LEDs, and it works well over distances of a few kilometers or less. We've got single mode cable that has a very thin core. It is harder to make and uses lasers as light sources and can transmit signals dozens of kilometers with ease. Any questions on any of the cabling types before we go into topologies? Yay, all right. So we're gonna go into topologies, and they actually simplified this in a big way from last year. So you guys are lucky in that regard. A network topology is a map of physical and logical layout of a network. The physical layout is how the devices on the network are physically laid out. The logical topology is how they communicate on the network, where what happens when a device wants to send a packet. That is the logical topology. Where does it go? How does it work? LAN architectures comprise all components that make up the structure of a communication system. This includes the hardware, software, protocols, and sequence operations. The type of topology determines the capacities of networks, such as ease of setup, speed, and cable lengths. So we're going to talk first about the physical topologies of LANs. The first one we've got is the bus topology, where each computer connects to a common cable, and the cable connects one computer to the next, like a bus line going through a city. The cable has a small cap installed at the end called a terminator, and this is to prevent signals from bouncing back and causing network errors.
Okay, I've got to do the Terminator joke. Here we go. And if the Terminator falls off the end, it's hasta la vista, little network connectivity. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, so you're not going to see many of these. Does anyone use these anymore? Okay.
Not often.
No, I don't think so. I've never seen one. You've got a ring topology. In a ring topology, hosts are connected in a physical ring or circle. Because the ring topology has no beginning or end, the cable does not need to be terminated. A specifically formatted frame called a token travels around the ring, stopping at each host. if a host wants to transmit data, the host adds the data, and the destination has it addresses to the frame. The frame then continues around the ring until the frame stops at the host with the destination address. The destination host takes the data out of the frame, and there you go. So it's like the pass the shell game type of thing. When you have the shell, you can put your data on or talk or whatever. And whoever has the shell can put their data on. If you don't have the shell, you can't. Does that make sense?
Anybody still awake?
Guys awake?
Yeah, I think so. Sure. When do you see ring topologies?
Yeah.
Banks. Token ring. Banks. Networks that require non-graceful degradation of performance as load increases, which is gobbledygook for saying when the net gets busy, it all doesn't go down to pieces. Lots of the SNA and DNA architecture in IBM mainframes is token ring because it is reliable and easily troubleshootable.
Okay. The most common topology that you're going to see is the star topology. It has a central connection point, which is normally a device such as a hub switch or router. It's usually going to be your multi-purpose device for you guys. And each host on a network has a cable segment that attaches the host directly to the central connection point. The advantage of a star topology is that it is easy to troubleshoot. Each host is connected to the central device with its own wire. If there's a problem with that cable, only the host is affected, so it's not going to bring your whole network down. Now, if a ring or bus, if there's a problem with the cable, you're done. So that is one advantage of the star. The rest of the network remains operational. We've got the hierarchical extended star topology. And this is a star network with an additional networking device connected to a main networking device. Typically, a network cable connected to one hub and then several other hubs connected to the first hub. large networks such as those of corporations or university use the hierarchical star topology. And this is kind of hard to actually visualize. But it's basically a way of connecting a few different network segments together to make one big network. A mesh topology, the most expensive but most reliable topology that you can have. Every device is connected to every other device, and a failure on any cable does not affect the network. The mesh topology is used in A1 that interconnects LANs, it's very, very expensive to actually maintain this. Any questions?
This chapter seems like a lot of information, guys, and I realize that every time we go through Chapter 8, everybody goes... but networks are so intrinsic to computers... Looks like we're having connectivity issues.
What in the weirdness?
We're having 76 millisecond ping where we are.
Did you get booted, Sean?
Yeah, did you get booted, Sean?
No, I booted myself. My ping was like 3,000 something at one point.
Yeah.
I should still be here.
Are you breaking up, or is that just you letting go of your key or something, which wouldn't be like you normally? We've got a ping of 80 here. 76.
82.
Maybe the election's finally caught up with the internet in the US. Just kidding.
No, I'm not. Okay. 10:35.
How many people can still hear us on here, clearly?
And how bad's the lag?
But no, yeah. I booted myself.
I can't tell, but I can hear you.
Oh, that's not so bad.
Yeah, we expect 260. Anything under 500's not bad. Anything over 500, then, yeah, it's a bit strange. Dunno. Well, the recording's going to come out cleanly, so maybe you should finish it anyway, Grace, or we're just going to be behind regardless.
Yeah, well, we're not going to finish the chapter, but I will finish the section that we're in, the topologies and stuff. There are two types of topologies, broadcast and token passing. A broadcast topology is a first-come, first-served thing. A host sends data to another device, or it can send data to all hosts on the network. Token passing. Oh man. Okay. Whoa. That was a long time ago. Okay. Alright. So it's a first come, first serve. Yes, it would be a logical star. And basically a physical star as well. Okay.
Bum bum bum.
Yeah, it looks like it. Okay, a host sends this to another device, so it's first come, first serve, so whenever a host sees a clear space, it's going to send its data. Now, token passing controls network access by passing an electronic token sequentially to each host. When a host receives a token, it can send data on the network. If the host has no data to send, it passes the token to the next host, and the process repeats itself. The physical and logical topology make up the LAN's architecture. The Ethernet architecture is based on the IEEE 802.3 standard. The IEEE 802.3 standards specifies that a network uses carrier-sense multiple access with collision detection. CSMA/CD, access control method. In this method, the hosts access the network using first-serve broadcast topology, and Ethernet uses a logical bus broadcast topology and either a bus or star physical topology. As networks expand, most Ethernet networks are implemented using an extended star or hierarchical star standard. Any questions on any of that? Did you guys get most of that?
You haven't dropped out at all here. You're fine.
Weird. Must be a US thing.
Yes, I'm hearing you quite okay as well.
Okay. Well, US thing. Okay.
Yeah, I lost you for a little while.
Yep, there's some weirdness going on in your guys' neck of the woods. Alright, so standard rates of transfer are 10 Mbps, 100 Mbps, or gigabit Ethernet, which can reach speeds of 1000 Mbps, funnily enough. We've got the token ring architecture. This architecture was created by IBM to be reliable network architecture. A lot of banks use it, as Carrie said. Token ring is used for computers and mainframes. Token ring is an example of an architecture in which physical topology is actually different from its logical topology. The token ring topology is referred to as the star wire ring because its outer appearance of the network design is of a star. The computers connect to a central hub called a multi-station access unit, MSAU. Inside the device, however, the wiring is forms an actual circular path, creating a logical ring. The logical ring is created by the token traveling out of the of an MSAU port to a computer. If the computer does not have any data to send, the token is sent back to the MSAU port and then out to the next port. And it just keeps going on until a computer actually has data. This process continues for all computers and therefore resembles a physical ring. And this happens faster than you guys can even think about it. So there you go. The last architecture we're going to talk about is FDDI. This is Fiber Distributed Data Interface. This is a type of token ring network. The implementation and topology of FDDI differs from the IBM token ring LAN architecture because it has two rings. It is often used to connect several buildings in an office complex or on a university campus. It runs on fiber optic cable, and it combines the high speed performance of fiber with the reliability of the token passing method. It runs at 100 megabits per second on a dual-ring topology, as I said, two rings. The outer ring is called the primary ring, and the inner ring is called the secondary ring. Normally, traffic flows only on the primary ring. If the primary ring fails, the data automatically flows onto the secondary ring in the opposite direction. This supports a maximum of 500 computers per ring, and the total distance of each length of cable ring is 100 kilometers or 62 miles. A repeater, which is a device that regenerates signals, is required about every 2 kilometers or 1.2 miles. In recent years, many token ring networks have been replaced by faster Ethernet networks because we've got gigabit. Any questions on any of that, guys?
None spring to mind.
Cool.
Does anyone know if Token Ring ever went above 16 megabits? I think that was there was 4 16. I wonder if they ever came in.
No, there was actually a 100 meg implementation of Token Ring, as far as I recollect. They actually did do a 100 megabit per second Token Ring. Oh, I should keep talking while Grace has the coffee in her hand.
No, I just had a sip of coffee. Okay, we'll go over standards, which are used by manufacturers to make sure that devices will be compatible with each other. The standards group create, examine, and update standards. These standards are applied to the development of technology to meet the demands of higher bandwidth, efficiency, communication, and reliable services. Okay, you've got a diagram here that is seriously a couple pages on all of these different standards organizations. If I sat here and read it to you, which is basically what I'd be doing, it would just take up a bunch of time. So I think you guys can have a look at that diagram on your own. If you have any questions about any standard organizations, tons of Wikipedia articles, write to the list, write to me. We'll talk about the Ethernet standards and IEEE, which is the people who actually make the Ethernet standards. So those are the actual real important ones. And I will tell you the standard numbers that you will need for your tests. So just have a look at that and read that diagram as just for your information. Okay, the standard that governs cabled Ethernet is called 802.3. It's an IEEE standard. It's IEEE 802.3. That's something you'll need to know. This is one standard number that you'll need to be that you'll be tested on, so yeah. This standard, what were you going to say? Somebody said what? Okay, this governs your Ethernet, your cabled Ethernet. 802.3 governs cabled Ethernet. This standard says that cabled Ethernet networks must use the CSMA/CD access control method, as we've said. So what happens is all N stations listen to the network wire for clearance to send data, much like we listen for cars when we cross the street, because we don't want to step out in front of one. When the station sees no other hosts are sending data, it then is able to send its data. If another N station observes the same clear signal and transmits the data at the same time, a collision occurs and on the network media. The first station that detects the collision, or doubling of voltage, because that's what happens when a collision occurs, sends out a jam signal that tells all stations to stop transmitting and to run a back-off algorithm. A back-off algorithm calculates random times in which the end station will start to try network transmission again. This random time is typically 1 or 2 milliseconds, or thousandths of a second. So this happens all without you even knowing, all the time, just very quickly. It's not going to slow down your computing unless there's some significant congestion. This occurs every time there is a collision and can reduce Ethernet transmissions by up to 40% if it gets really bad. Usually it's not. Any questions on the CSD/MA?
You mean CSMA/CD, yeah. But that's okay.
That one.
Just think, smacked.
Carol is smacked.
I don't think it's in your test. It's okay, but we do have to mention it because it is the contention method.
Yeah, it is actually. Which one does?
I think it is.
It actually use. It isn't.
I think it is.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
Indirectly, but I think it is sort of it.
Yeah.
I was wondering when Kasmacht was going to happen. I knew Carrie was going to say it sometime.
Okay, any questions on how that works? Okay. The thing you want to remember is that it's for collision avoidance, or collision detection. Wireless actually uses collision avoidance. So wired is collision detection, so CD. Wireless is CA. That is the main thing that you're going to want to look at if you see a question like that on the test. The standard also specifies which physical technologies can be used on Ethernet networks, because you want all the physical technologies to be compatible with each other. We've got 10BASE-T. This is an Ethernet technology that uses a star topology. 10BASE-T is a popular Ethernet architecture whose features are indicated in its name. So, the 10 represents a speed of 10 megabits per second. The base represents baseband transmissions. In baseband transmissions, the entire bandwidth of a cable is used for one type of signal. The T represents twisted pair copper cabling. So, 10BASE-T copper cabling goes at 10 megabits per second and uses twisted pair cabling. There are many advantages to using 10BASE-T. Installation of cable is inexpensive compared to fiber optic installation. Cables are thin and flexible and easier to install than coaxial cabling. Equipment and cables are easy to upgrade, and there are also some disadvantages. The maximum length for a 10BASE-T segment is only 100 meters, 328 feet. Hey, that goes for all of your twisted pair cabling. Remember that. And cables are susceptible to EMI. We've got fast internet. The high bandwidth demands of many modern applications, such as live video conferencing and streaming audio, have created a need for higher data transfer speeds. Imagine if we could only go at 10 megabits per second. Many networks require more bandwidth than 10 megabits. Yeah. So we've got 100BASE-T. So can anyone tell me how fast you think that 100BASE-T is going to go?
100 megabits per second.
Good for you. That's absolutely right. Now, something you need to remember, because this is a gotcha on the test. If they ask you what the 100 in 100BASE-T stands for, it is not the number of meters that the cable can be long. Even though that's also true, it is the speed. So 10, 100, 1000BASE-T always has to do with the speed, not the length. All right. Same type of advantages. It is much faster than 10BASE-T. You can use the Cat5 and Cat5D cabling, as we've said before. It's inexpensive and all that, so it still has most of the advantages of 10BASE-T. The wires are a little bit thicker, though, so a little less easy to install, but honestly, Ethernet cables are pretty easy. We've got Gigabit Ethernet, and this is 1000BASE-T. That means it can go theoretically up to 1 gigabit per second, and this is really fast. Same advantages, but you must use Cat5e and probably even better Cat6 cabling for gigabit Ethernet to get all of the speed that you're going to want out of that cable. 10BASE-T, 100BASE-T, and gigabit standards are backwards compatible with each other, but if you plug a 100 megabit device into a gigabit network, your whole network could slow down. Any questions on that?
Well, that segment would slow down. I mean, in theory, data on the other segments of a switch would not, but data to that particular one would.
That depends on the switch. Carrie?
No, he's right. It can slow down. Okay. It all depends on...
No, it can slow down, but it'll slow down... the switch can slow the whole network down, can't it?
No. Because a switch is actually responsible for micro-segmenting the network. So what actually happens is that when it splits the network into lots of little segments, those segments are theoretically supposed to operate independently of each other, and the switch should not degrade the entire net performance. A hub would, though.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, we're going to finally today go over wireless networks, which are governed by 802.11, or the Wi-Fi standard. This is another standard number you must know. The other things you're going to want to know is the basics of each of the four standards that are contained in 802.11.
Bang!
So, bang. Yes, bang. B-A-G-N. But really, it's ABGN, and I'll explain to you each of these standards in that order, because that's the order they came out. So the first one we've got is 802.11a. It allows wireless LANs to achieve data rates as high as 54 megabits per second, and devices operate in the 5 GHz radio frequency range. They only have a maximum range of 45.7 meters or 150 feet, so very short range comparatively. Then we have 802.11b. This operates in the 2.4 gigahertz frequency range with a maximum theoretical data rate of 11 megabits per second. And they are actually able to have a much longer range of 91 meters or 300 feet. So we've got twice the range, but they are slow. 802.11g provides the same theoretical maximum speed as 802.11a, which is 54 megabits per second, but operates in the same 2.4 gigahertz spectrum as B does. Unlike A, 802.11g is backwards compatible with B. It also has a maximum range of 91 meters or 300 feet. So this is the basic summary of what you need to know from that. 802.11a is fast but low range, and not backward compatible with B. 802.11b is slower than A but can travel farther. 802.11g is the best of both worlds and is backward compatible with B because it runs on the same frequencies. Any questions on those three? Cool. You'll get one of those in your test, so you'll need to actually keep track of those and just study that. It's in your textbook. Okay, the final standard for wireless is 802.11n, which is a newer wireless standard that has a theoretical bandwidth of 540 megabits per second and operates in either 2.4 GHz or 5 GHz frequencies. The maximum range is 250 meters or 984 feet. So there you go. I think we're going to end here because the next thing we go into is TCP/IP layered model and OSI reference model. You don't want to do that now. You want to do that when you're fresh. So we'll come back to that, go through the types of services ISPs can provide to you. And we'll be done with this chapter next week and go into chapter 9, which is security, which is so much easier than this chapter. And then coming up after that, we'll have our 10, module 10, and that will end up with our role play. And then we will start two sessions per week, if that's okay with everybody. To finish up 11 through 16. We're not doing 14 because nobody wants to do it. That's fine. And
I did some of it, and you're not missing much, guys.
Really not. If anyone wants,
it's more
it,
printers. But you got printers, yeah, so hard in chapter 7 that it's.
It's pretty much not something we need to do unless you guys really want to do it. Then you'll get to graduate and have certificates and whatever else, so it's all good. Any questions, comments, concerns before we stop recording?
Can we go back to wireless N for a sec? You said it operates in either
4
or 5.8. It operates in either of those. I actually got an access point that can do both. I got a free Cisco access point. The interesting thing is when I set it into the 5.8 range, all my netbooks stop working and the iPhone stops working, and only my Mac computer can see it. So I think a lot of these netbooks and stuff are NDraft and seem to be limited to the 2.4 range.
No. It's optional for it to work in both bands. There's actually two bands that N can work in, but there's nothing that says in the standard that it has to work in both bands. So lots of N cars just have 2.4 gig antennas, and they're just like, well, we're not putting another 5.8 gig radio in. We don't have the real estate. Meh. So, yeah, that's how that works. A lot of devices...
Can you add N to get it out of the cell phone range, or the portable phone and microwave?
Well, that was half the point of it. We're having Remembrance Day, sort of silence, but yeah. N is basically, it can work in either band, and the idea was to shift... things out of the 2.4 gig band, but the problem is that a lot of devices didn't have room for the 5.8 gig antennas. The 5.8 gigs doesn't travel as far, and whilst there's less interference, it is more circuitry and sometimes more power drain. So not all N devices will sit up on 5.8 gigs.
Now, who are we supposed to remember?
Huh? Remembrance Day, 11th of the 11th. It was the day that World War II and Amnestist in 1945. So lots of people passed away, and we're very sad about that.
Your guys is equivalent to Veterans Day, which we're having tomorrow.
and really, really observant, too.
Yeah, you guys do.
Oh, absolutely not. But Brian wanted the answer to his question, so...
Yeah, so be aware, guys, that not all N devices will support the 5.8 gig band. I believe, and I'd have to check this, but I believe our N access points, Grace, are only 2.4. They don't go into 5.8 because that distance isn't that great.
I had a very cool Linksys, and I had my two devices that would go on N. In 5.8, so I just seriously put up a 5.8 access point, and I basically had my own segment on the network, and it was really good.
Yeah, I have too much backwards stuff that I need. Like, if the netbooks can't work roaming around the house, I don't want one. I mean, it's no good to me. That's why I have it in the first place.
Fair enough.
It is possible to upgrade the cards in the netbooks, but taking them apart and stuff can tend to be just too tedious, and you can't be bothered, and then you've got to run other antenna wires, and it's like, meh, too hard.
Yeah, sounds too hard. I'll just leave it at 2.4 and hope the phones don't interfere, which they usually don't.
Well, not that I would be condoning illegal behavior, but one of the other things you can do is a lot of the cards will go up onto channel 13 and 12 and in some cases 14 if you change the country regions. However, I won't be responsible if the FCC or whatever you guys have got knock on your door, but sometimes you can actually shift up onto channel 13 and get some quiet channel space that way. I knew a lot of people who ran their wireless access points in Japanese mode because it would do channel 14, and then they got their other cards to jump up there with a couple of registry patches and stuff, so nifty stuff.
I don't actually know what the Canadian regulations are. I'm not sure. I don't think 13 is allowed here, but I'm going to check just for fun.
Yeah, it's always interesting to know.
Yeah, I think US is 1 to 10.
1 to 11.
I think. 1 to 11. And Australia is 1 to 13.
Remember that if you're buying, you're in Australia and you're buying devices that were in the US, you won't be able to go up to, you know, if you're like you're, you won't be able to necessarily
I've
go up
seen,
to 12, 13.
I was just going
to
talk about this. I've actually seen the, third party firmware on routers access channels other than higher than 11, but it's likely that if you're operating in the US, then your wireless card will not be able to get that.
Yeah.
There are bits and stuff in the hardware that you can set in some wireless cards that actually check the, set the country. And in fact, one of the things we noticed was a lot of the Intel 2200 BG cards by default would only go from 1 to 11, whereas in fact we were actually allowed to roam from 1 to 13. So it's an interesting problem. And if you actually put access points up on 12 and 13, sometimes there are people who come over to your house that can't see them.
I doubt that our iPods would be able to.
We'll have to try it.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting little experiment.
Well, they came out of China. I can just shift one of the unused access points up onto 13 and see what happens. And then if you get some of the Ubiquiti gear, it can go onto channel minus 1 and minus 2 and all sorts of things. You just twiddle it and it'll shift out of spectrum quite nicely.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty cool gear, the Ubiquiti stuff. Little access point about the size of a packet of cigarettes that can send a signal about 20 kilometers.
And they've got these little satellite dishes, repeaters, that are about the size of a dinner plate.
Yeah, and you put the thing in the middle of the satellite dish and clip it in, and your access point sits in the focus of the dish, and then there's a USB plug on the other end, and you run a USB cable to your computer, and off you go. You're online. It's amazing. As I said, we actually know one of the Cisco instructors that goes on holidays with a Yagi beam antenna in his backpack, so he can just pull it all out, set it all up, and get free Wi-Fi anywhere. They just point it out the motel window.
Well.
Right, time to go home. Have a good night.
All right. You too.
So, yeah.
All right. Cheerio, all.
Yeah, chill out.